Well, McDonald said, you had your hunt. Yes, sir. And you lost your tail, just like I said you would. Andrews did not speak. That was what you wanted, wasn't it? McDonald asked. Maybe it was in the beginning, Andrews said. Part of it, at least. Young people, McDonald said. Always wanting to start from scratch, I know. You never figured that someone else knew what you was trying to do, did you? I never thought about it, Andrews said. Maybe because I didn't know what I was trying to do myself. Do you know now? Andrews moved restlessly. Young people, McDonald said contemptuously. You always think there's something to find out. Yes, sir, Andrews said. Well, there's nothing, McDonald said. You get born and you nurse on lies and you get weaned on lies and you learn fancier lies in school. You live all your life on lies, and then maybe when you're ready to die, it comes to you that there's nothing, nothing but yourself and what you could have done. Only you ain't done it because the lies told you there was something else. Then you know you could have had the world because you're the only one that knows that secret. Only then it's too late. You're too old. No, Andrews said. A vague terror crept from the darkness that surrounded them and tightened his voice. That's not the way it is. You ain't learned then, McDonald said. You ain't learned yet. Look, you spend nearly a year of your life in sweat because you have the faith and the dream of a fool. And what have you got? Nothing. You kill 3,000-4,000 buffalo and stack their skins neat, and the buffalo will rot wherever you left them, and the rats will nest in the skins. And what have you got to show? A year gone out of your life, a busted wagon that a beaver might use to make a dam with, some calluses on your hand, and the memory of a dead man. No, Andrews said, that's not all. That's not all I have. What does he have? In an effort to obliterate the memory of this bitter winter, and probably in an effort to reaffirm his sense of his own existence, young Andrews has taken up with a dance hall lady named Francine. He encounters Charlie Hoag on the street and discovers, to another of his horrors, that Charlie Hoag, a fundamentalist drunkard, has gone mad. Miller's looking for you, Charlie Hoag went on in a high, monotonous voice. Miller says we're all going somewhere to kill the buffalo. He knows a place in Colorado. I think he wants to see you. Charlie, Andrews said. His voice trembled, and he clutched his hands hard around the glass to keep from them shaking. Charlie, get hold of yourself. We're going on a hunt, Charlie Hoag continued in his sing-song voice. You and me and Miller. Miller knows a skinner we can get in Ellsworth. It'll be all right. I'm not afraid to go up there anymore. The Lord will provide. He smiled and nodded and continued nodding toward Andrews, though his eyes had turned downward to his glass of whiskey. Don't you remember, Charlie? Andrews' voice was hollow. Don't you remember anything about it? Remember? Charlie Hoag asked. The mountains, the hunt, Schneider. That's his name, Charlie Hoag said. Schneider. That's the skinner in Ellsworth that Miller's going to get. Don't you remember? Andrews' voice cracked. Schneider's dead. Charlie Hoag looked at Andrews, shook his head, and smiled. A drop of spittle gathered on his lower lip, swelled, and coursed into the gray stubble around his chin. Nobody dies, he said softly. The Lord will provide. For another moment, Andrews looked deep into Charlie Hoag's eyes. Dull and blue, they were like bits of empty sky reflected in a dirty pool. There was nothing behind them, nothing to stop Andrews' gaze from going on and on. With almost a sense of horror, Andrews drew back and shook his head with a sharp movement. He got up from the table and backed away. Charlie Hoag did not change his empty stare or give any sign that he saw Andrews' movement. Andrews turned and walked swiftly out of the bar. On the sidewalk, in the bright sunlight, the sense lingered. His legs were weak and his hands were trembling. Swiftly, unsteadily, he went up the street, turned, and took the stairs that led up the side of Jackson's saloon to Francine's room. He opened his eyes wide to the dimness of the room. He was still breathing heavily. Francine, lying on the bed, raised herself on an elbow and looked at him. With that movement, her loose gray wrapper parted, and one breast drooped toward her forearm, pale against the gray material. Andrews went quickly to the bed. Almost roughly, he pulled the wrapper away from her body and let his hands run swiftly, desperately over her. A small smile came upon Francine's face. Her lids dropped. Her hands came to Andrews, fumbled with his clothing, and pulled him down upon her. Later, as he lay beside her, the tumult within him quieted. He tried to tell her of his meeting with Charlie Hogue and of that sense of horror that the meeting had released in him. It was not, he tried to make her understand, so much a result of his recognition that what Charlie Hogue showed him in a blind and enveloping stare was something that each of them, Miller, Charlie Hogue, Schneider, and even himself, that each of them had had inside them all along. It was something, he tried to tell her, that MacDonald had spoken of by the flickering light of a lantern in the great empty sleeping house the night they had returned to Butcher's Crossing. It was something that he had seen in Schneider's face as he stood stiff and upright in the middle of the river just after the horse's hoof had split his skull. It was something. The faint afterlift of a smile hung on Francine's full, pale lips. She nodded. Her hand moved softly, soothingly, over his bare chest. It was something, he continued, speaking in broken phrases that did not say what he intended. It was something that he had felt even in himself from moment to moment during the long trek across the plains and in the kill of the buffalo at the instant the great animal shuddered and crashed to the ground, and in the hot, smothering stench that came with the skinning, and in the vision of whiteness during the snowstorm, and in the trackless view of the aftermath of the storm. Was it in everyone, he asked, without using the words? Did it lurk, hidden in everyone, waiting to spring out, waiting to devour and rend, until there was left only the blankness he had seen in the blue stare that Charlie Hogue now had to give the world? Or did it wait without, crouched like a timber wolf behind a rock, to spring suddenly and without reason upon anyone who passed it by? Or beyond one's knowledge did it seek it out, this shape of terror, and pass it by in an obscure, perverse hope that it might spring? At that swift moment in the river, did the splintered log seek the belly of Schneider's horse and the hoof Schneider's skull? Or was it the other way around, Schneider passing by precisely in search of the gray shape and finding it? What did it mean, he wanted to know? Where had he been? He turned on the bed. Beside him, Francine dropped into a light sleep. Her breath came gently from her parted lips, and her hands lay loosely curled at her sides. He got up quietly, went across the room, turned the wick of the lamp down, and blew into the chimney, extinguishing the light. Through the single curtained window across from him, a last gray light flickered. Outside, it was growing dark. He returned to the bed and lay carefully next to Francine, on his side, looking at her. What did it mean? He asked himself again. Even this, he hesitated to call it love. His hunger after Francine, what did it mean? He thought again of Schneider, and suddenly he imagined Schneider in his place, alive, lying beside Francine. Without anger or resentment, he saw him lying there and saw him reach across and fondle Francine's breast. He smiled, for he knew that Schneider would not have questioned as he was questioning, would not have wondered, would not have let a look from Charlie Hogue loose within him these doubts and these fears. With a kind of rough and sour friendliness, he would have taken his pleasure from Francine and would have gone his way and would not in any particular manner have thought of her again, as Francine would not have thought of him again. And he added suddenly, as Francine probably would not think again of him, Will Andrews, who now lay beside her. In her sleep, in a whisper, Francine mouthed a word that he could not understand. She smiled, her breath caught, she breathed deeply, and moved a little beside him. Though he did not want the thought to come to him, he knew that he too, like Schneider, would leave her, would go his own way. Though unlike Schneider, he would think of her, remember her, in a way that he could not yet predict. He would leave her, and he would not know her. He would never know her. Now the darkness was nearly complete in the room. He could barely see her face. With his eyes open in the darkness, he slid his hand down her arm until he found her hand and lay quietly beside her. He thought of the men who had known her appetite and flesh as he had known them, and had known nothing else. He thought of those men without resentment. In the dark they were faceless, and they did not speak, and they lay in their breathing like himself. After a long while, his hand still loosely clasping Francine's hand, he slept.